This is almost the quietest moment you're going to have all week in Cape Town, I think. It's fantastic that the art week, the art fair has become a part of the art week in Cape Town, where people from all over the world converge on our beautiful city to share in the creativity and enjoy the beauty of our artists and our people and what we are capable of. And we are very proud to have everyone here, and we look forward to what proves what promises to be another fantastic spectacle of creativity and talent. Ernest Mancobo is a very interesting case study. He left South Africa already in 1938. Now, a lot of us are very well know the work of Gerard Sokoto very well. And Sokoto, for many years, was almost the flagship South African black artist that immigrated from South Africa and left. But in fact, Mancobo left 8 years before Sokoto did. And he became almost the first South African that really became part of a major art movement, the Cobra movement, that were, you know, included in art history, so to speak. But for many years, a lot of people knew more about Jamila Feni, who also immigrated, and Gerard Sokoto than they did about Ernest Mancobo. We're very fortunate that there's a drive all across the world to give renewed interest and recognition to the artists of the Cobra movement, and with that, renewed interest on Ernest Mancobo. And we thought it's only appropriate that in South Africa we also do our part to learn more and to appreciate and better understand one of the finest artists that this Africa ever delivered. So, from the Strauss & Company point of view, you know, we believe if the art ecosystem is healthy, then we will flourish. So we really do invest quite widely in events and education in art, way beyond what is just narrow-mindedly the interest of the art auction house, because we're all participants in the same team. We're all playing for the same game. We all have the same goals in the end. And it's wonderful, Winnie, to team up with you. We had this passion for this idea and wouldn't give up. And she's not a lady to be underestimate, I can tell you. So all year, she really, really wanted this to happen. So thank you so much, Winnie, to you for your insight and perseverance, also for your love of Ernest's work. And just obviously for you guys to make this available. It's really fantastic. And we love the collaboration, the way that we so comfortably and without much hassle or politics work together. I think the art scene in Cape Town has come of age, and we will hopefully become even better in the future. It's wonderful to see how the institutions are working together. For me personally, it was absolutely fantastic to see Kendrick's exhibition at both the sites and at the Norwalk Foundation. I think that shows a level of maturity and insight and a vision towards the future that I think will really bode well for all of us. So, Winnie, over to you and Mabuso. We look forward to hearing what you have to say. And Ernest Mancobo's work, and to many extent for a lot of South Africans, will need a bit of decoding, because he clearly worked in a very different way than we were accustomed in South Africa. But enigmatic and amazing artist, and we look forward to learning more about his work.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Well, thank you everyone for your time. We're just going to do 30 minutes. So I'm Winnie. I'm the pushy one. That's not what Frank said, but that's what he meant. And it's okay. I'm okay with that. I'm pushy. And Nomusa, she's the nice one. So that's all you have to know.
That's okay. Nice is fine. Pushy, yes, maybe. But a good working team, I think.
So we just thought we would just... Like, we're friends as well as co-conveners of this. So we just thought we'd just be in conversation, which basically means we didn't really prepare. So, but it also means that if you have something you'd like to say, then please contribute. But before we start, I just want to say that tonight's reception is an opening, if you like, for tomorrow. Tomorrow we have a full conference starting from 9, registration 8:30, 9 o'clock till 6 o'clock. Well, I'm hoping to finish by 5:30. So say 9 to 5:30. And I just want to introduce some of the international speakers and local and South African speakers who are here contributing to that before we start. So just wave. So, sorry. Well, anyway, so I'm just giving them a heads up that I'm kind of pointing at them. So Karen Kurzinski is from America. And Dorta Agassen is from Denmark. And where is Alicia from Paris? And Professor Luvuyo Moshela, many of you will know. He is Mr. History of South Africa. And I think that's all my speakers so far. But there's actually a lot. Oh, where's Willem? Oh, sorry, Willem. I'm so sorry. I didn't see you. Hi, Willem. But other speakers will drift in towards the end of the evening. And there's agendas if you want to see what's happening, or just speak to me afterwards. But anyway, without further ado, for about 30 minutes, we'll just have a conversation.
Yes, I think we thought maybe we would start with this sort of easy conversation, because we really wanted this conference to not have a conference feel, but to have this dialogue feel. So we're not really presenting the facts about Mangoba, but we're finding new avenues to interpret his works, to find the rich meanings. So we thought that maybe, you know, it's a good idea to start with an easy conversation. And of course, the first question that we're going to pose to each other is, why are we doing this? Mm-hmm. And perhaps maybe you can answer that and I'll follow.
So, you can tell from my accent, I'm not South African. The Stevenson had an amazing exhibition of the artist, his wife, and his son's work a few years ago. Many of you might have seen it. And then that just really intrigued me. I didn't know about this artist. And then I just wanted to know more. And then a few years ago, 2017, I had an opportunity to do a research fellowship at the Van Abbey Museum in Eindhoven in the Netherlands. And I said to them, this relationship between Mangoba and Cobra, where he's supposedly a Cobra artist, but he's been forgotten because of race, I'd like to look at that. And then they accepted that. So I wrote a paper and then just began, like, if you like, a lifelong love affair of this. But one of the things that happened while I was doing the research was I found out a lot about his life. I found out, like, when he was born, 1904, but that actually he also lied about his age. He said that he was born 1910 for a long time, not 1904. The reason was he fell in love and he didn't want his girlfriend to know that he was that much more older than him. That was so. I found out a lot about him. He died in 2002, and he moved, as Frank said, 1938 to Paris. But I couldn't find anything about his art. Like I'm doing this research, and I'm thinking, okay, well, I just see two works, but surely that can't be. And it just really struggled to just find the work. So then it became like a passion and an interest to just see what was his work like and what inspired his work. So that was my reason. And you?
Okay, my reason is because I teach first years at UCT at Michaelis. I'm an associate professor there. And the first time I had to teach a course on modernism, when I found it, it was a course that focused on all the modern movements in Europe. So, you know, we went through Impressionism, Post-Impressionism. And when I started working on that course, I thought, well, many of these movements actually had a lot of artists coming from different places that collaborated, for example, Mangoba with Cobra. And I thought, well, and there's very little that's being said about that. And so what I decided to do was to focus on post-colonial modernism, which is an area of research that, at least based on the book by Chika Okeke Agulu, who is a professor from Princeton, who will be our keynote tomorrow, where he says there's a distinct sense of modernism that was established on the continent, but of course it was distinct because a lot of the people who started much of the discussion, or rather the discourse around modernism, were also trained in Europe. So a lot of African artists who were trained in Europe, practicing in Europe, and coming back to Africa. So I would start in Senegal, and you know, have all these amazing examples. And then we would come to South Africa. And then I would have to present artists like Sikodo and Mangoba. And when it came to Mangoba, the only writing I could find was the article that Rashid Arayin wrote, or of course there's Lisa's work. But it's very scarce here and there. Some research being done, but it's not tons of work of books that you could find. So you know, it's not like when you're looking for Picasso, you know, we have a whole shelf of books that students could find. But it's not so with Mangoba, and it may be so. You know, even in the case of Gerard Sikodo, I took out all the books written on Sikodo, and I could probably just fit them on just one shelf like this. And I thought, well, this is not enough. So surely we have to create the platforms for scholars who may or may not be interested in artists like Mangoba, but are doing very interesting things around that same part of history to be able to enable us to see the various facets of that work. And one other thing I think that I came across, so there was the one, but I think I was doing this course in 2017 or 2016, and I invited Winnie to come and do a lecture on Mangoba. And I think that was the first time we actually discovered all of these personal stories that were just amazing. And students were just bowled over. And also realized that they don't get to hear about any of these artists in high school. So this is the first time they encounter them. And also for people teaching, we don't actually have that much material except through researchers who are working on those artists. And so the platforms themselves become very important. But yes, I think it's this is, I'm hoping, the first of many. Oh, I was going to say, so there was the article that you wrote on the visibility of Mangoba, and that sometimes we may know about Mangoba the artist, but there's very little written about his work. I don't know if you wanted to maybe say more about that.
I mean, that was one thing that we just thought, that I find kind of interesting. Like, why is it that Sokoto, there's work, we know a lot about his life and his art, but then why don't we have that for Mangoba? Like, you know, there are some obvious answers, but let's not give ourselves an excuse, right? Let's think about why we don't. And my hypothesis is, and this isn't to just, because I brought up Sokoto, so I have to explain myself now. My hypothesis isn't to dismiss Sokoto because of Mangoba, because my hypothesis is Mangoba is complicated, and with all due respect to Sokoto, he's much more straightforward. Like his oeuvre, he started, you know, he and Mangoba were friends, and they overlapped for 1 year in a village near the northern Transvaal, where they went to village, and you know, they both speak about each other in their time, and I see some of the images from that period, like late 1930s, 1940s, and they're similar and continued on through his entire career. Obviously, there were changes, but overall, you could walk into a room and see a work and be like, yeah, I'm pretty sure this is Sokoto, like in a good way. But with the Mangoba, really difficult. Like, I don't know if anybody's had a chance to look through quickly, but like on the wall just behind Nomusa, there's like six panels, and they're a bit tiny, sorry. But it changed quite significantly. So on the top left-hand corner, he started out carving, and it's social realism, much like Sokoto's. And it's the Black Madonna, and it's a Madonna, like in a Western Madonna, but she's an African woman's face. And this is carved 1929. Below that is, you start to see like abstracted. So that one's called Faith, and it's also a figure holding a smaller figure. And I'm not saying it's a Madonna or whatever, but it's called Faith. But it's much less identifiable, and that was 1938. So we're talking like 9 years later, he's already moving away from social realism. Then you can see the works that are 2D works on the panel are much easier to see, and then you can see how they changed over time as well. And because of the influences, he actively absorbed, and I think that's one reason that's my hypothesis. I mean, but what do you think about
that? Yeah, I guess that's it's another thing that Irene also pointed out, was that he was one artist who couldn't be easily boxed into one style. And so it became very hard to refer to him as easily. So, I mean, I can imagine that in those years, there was a lot of interests in artists who were producing a style that aligned to ideas about Africanite, right? So African style, and there's something that's expected out of that. There's a characteristic. And Mangoba moved swiftly between different styles, and so could not be boxed into one category. And I think that's possibly what makes him a very exciting artist, but it's possibly what also has lent to his invisibility in many ways. I went to a panel at a conference a few years ago, and the entire panel discussed COBRA. There's not even a single mention of my mother.
Yeah. Yes. Well, Karen, one of the speakers I introduced earlier, her talk tomorrow will be about that. So, yeah. Yeah, it'd be good.
Yes.
So, I mean, do you think that there are other, I mean, we're focused on Mankoba, but do you think there are other South African artists who are also likewise difficult to kind of pin, to put in a box, and so then they suffer for that?
It's difficult to say, because I think their works that are probably, they have probably fallen off the radar.
Okay.
And I think similarly with Mankoba, their works that we don't know, you know, or maybe have been lost. And it's difficult to say because, of course, certain, you know, once you have an artist, there's a certain signature that becomes canonized. But I think the work that's begun, and you know, I think safe to say that there are quite a few curators and scholars now who are trying to do some of the work around modern artists. You know, there's an interest now with the, say for example, Nondobego on Gladys Mkudlandlu, and I think also, you know, working on abstraction, and modern artists, but particularly women. Mm-hmm. And then of course there's a sort of rising interest again in Sekoto and Pemba, which I think is particularly important because it needs to generate new forms of talking about these artists and talking about what is the content of the artwork itself, new ways of theorizing about that work.
Well, one of the things that you mentioned, and it's something that I've been interested in just learning about South African art, is in the general canon is towards social realism. So like it's representative. You can identify a person, you can identify a place, but maybe not a real place, but something maybe that is idealized or critical or something, you know? So I would say in general, that's my, and correct me and anybody if I'm overgeneralizing, but that would be in general the social realism in South Africa. And so what I'm curious about is like, so then Mankoba is abstraction, but there must be other artists in South Africa that works with abstraction, or do you think there was just something in the culture that for which social realism was the right way to go? In you know, like, I mean, people always think that artists kind of come up with everything just out of their head, which is somewhat true, but the acceptance by the platform, by the academics, by other artists, there has to be something for other people to agree with. You know, you can't just make something so completely new that people can't understand it. And so there has to be something that connects you. I'm not sure if I'm being clear. But like, so what is it about South African social realism, I guess, is my...
There's possibly there was a political impetus for social realism because I imagine that artists had to represent the circumstances that they found themselves in. And so in order to represent those circumstances, you know, abstraction seemed to be, you know, something that doesn't allow for that, for those kinds of messages to be clear. Mm. But I think that we also have to remember that a lot of these artists were living at around the time of, you know, end of the Second World War, and, you know, others during the politics of the Cold War. And so, of course, there was the political impetus to have very strong figural works. It's interesting, though, that you do find abstraction, and I think that you do find artists who shifted from that language. And I think, you know, following the life of Mankoba is one way to begin tracing, you know, what has now become forgotten. I mean, for many years, we've become more used to things like township art. There's, you know, there's a kind of expectation of what African artists should be doing that I think we need to begin to break down those assumptions, and we can do that by finding the artists in history who went against those conventions. And I'm sure Manloba is one amongst many, but we're just not doing the work of finding, you know, finding them or finding that work particularly.
Because when we, through my research, one influence taking Manloba towards abstraction was he read this book. And today it's a very cringeworthy title. It was 1929, and it was called Primitive Negro Sculptures, and it was written in 1926, and it was written by a French art dealer, and in fact he sold, I don't know how many of you know the Barnes Foundation in America, but the author, the French art dealer, he sold all the works that went into the Barnes Foundation. And he wrote in this book, Primitive Negro Sculptures, actually quite a really, like a really respectful and an insightful way of like how to look at antique West African art. So he talked about, you know, if you look at modern European, if you look at European art, it came out of the classical. It was coming out of the classical period, so the body was idealized. You know, everyone was perfect. Like the marble was just simply to capture the perfection of humans and what we could attain. And he then wrote that in comparison, if you look at a Negro sculpture, I'm just using his words, his quote, then you're gonna have like, you know, like the head's this big, and it's not like anything you're ever gonna feel real. So he understood this part and explained it. But then he said, but that allows artistic freedom. That allows that you could just not be bound by a perfect human. You could then just be about what he called the plasticity or the form, you know, that you could create patterns and rhythms. And in that way, you can understand like the potential of a human rather than just the physicality of a human. And this book, Manloba read in the National Library. Actually, we could all read it. I read it in the National Library, although the National Library is very special, and then you just must be very patient, really. But you can read it. I'm just pushy, I told you. So he talked about it. He read in 1938, and he the last interview in his life, which was given in 2002. He brought that book up again. It was a book that really mattered to him, and he carved faith after the more abstracted work after that. And it was strangely like a way to think, I'm learning about African, okay, I'll be a West African, but Africa through this intermediation of this book. Mm-hmm. And that the fact that, you know, it was a way that Africans had of looking at the people, at the human, without being so literal about the human. So mm-hmm. I just found that quite like just something that I just like just resonates for me. I mean, how do you think that may or may not be the same for other artists in South Africa?
Well, I mean, I think one has to differentiate. So for the artists who, like Manloba, like Sekoto, ended up going abroad, I mean, I suppose many of them were cosmopolitan artists, and that's precisely what made them modern. Was that they were grappling with what seemed to be a changing tide in the politics of colonization and the emerging nation states, or at least the struggle towards emerging nation states after colonialism. And so, of course, the art was also a vehicle for them to create a kind of consciousness, and that finding that consciousness was finding it in classical African sculptures. At least that became the canon for, I mean, of course it's been criticized, but I think there was, you know, there was that tide that I think a lot of artists were also responding to in their different ways. And so, yes, they were very different, you know, it's also this differentiation, finding these differentiation, what makes African artists distinct. Mm. And so, of course, they found it in establishing these standards about, okay, well, African art, you know, has different sort of ideas around the proportion of the human body, and it's not about, you know, truthful representation of what it is you see. This, you know, it's much more deeper, and all of this became part of this building of African identities that would distinguish them from everyone else. And the one part of it was a way for African artists to vitalize their art and their practice, but the other part of it was, of course, a fascination in the first world with the African aesthetic that in some ways boxed African arts towards particular styles. And so I think, you know, that relationship is particularly important because it can tell us something about how those artists were responding to consciousness, or rather political consciousness around that time.
That Paris in that time, like, it was when Mancomann's diaries talk about going to the Bal Negro with like a nightclub, right? Was that the one Josephine Baker was in, or no? Anyway, well, okay, let's just play, pretend I didn't say that. But anyway, it was like an exotic nightclub, and, you know, like the French and African intellectuals went, but there was certainly. There was a bit of an exoticism as well.
So. Yeah, I mean, if you take Cobra, for example, I mean, Cobra, some of the work that was being done was about finding what's primitive in the human, not finding the primitive African. It was about finding what's primitive in every human being. And so, you know, some of that surrealism was based on, like, childlike drawings and so on. But, you know, their work sort of went into this kind of psychoanalytical space of understanding the id as a primitive space. And so, of course, that was around the same time when that was translated as, or rather at least equated with, okay, so the primitive therefore must equal what African artists are doing. You know, so it's a bit of a two-way, I don't know how to, perhaps a paradox, if one can call it that. So, you know, how do we today look at the way that Mangoba represented the Kota Railing Queer figure? Mm-hmm. You know, but he decided not to show us the Railing Queer figure as it is. You have to find it somehow in the abstractness. You have to find it in the paint brushes that are not there. Right, so you have to kind of make it out. I don't know if there's an example you have to make it out and say, well, if you look at these lines, I mean, I, you know, sometimes laugh with my students and they're like, yeah, okay, you're making this up. Rorschach, so if you look at these lines, there is a Kota Railing Queer figure, right? But we're trying to find it. And I think the fact that he takes the viewer there in doing the work of finding this thing is pointing us to the historical processes of caging these meanings into particular positions.
I don't know if he ever said they were Kotas, though. That's the only thing I don't, I mean.
But there was the interpretation after.
I think there might have been, and maybe Alicia knows, and she can address it tomorrow.
Yeah.
She's also done a lot of work. But, like, I don't think he ever said for sure it's a Kota. I don't think he ever denied
it
either.
We've done the work of finding it, I guess.
Do you know? Did he ever say? That he said it was?
He said that the central figure can refer to the Kota figure.
Yeah. He never said that. He said you can interpret you that can, way.
Yeah. But we do the work of interpreting, and so he's implicating us in that.
No, I'm not criticizing. Because, in fact, it sort of makes a lot of sense. The Kota is regular query from West Africa, and he would have seen it. And a lot of people think he would have seen it in South Africa, but that wouldn't have been true because Kotas are not South African. But he would have seen it in, with all due respect, primitive Negro sculptures, the British Museum, and the Musée de l'Homme in Paris. So he wouldn't have really seen it here, or he wouldn't have seen it in a formal setting, shall we say. But it would have spoken to him, right? Like, you know, like, his work is about humanity, and the African culture is about so humanity isn't just, you know, my good friend Nomusa and everyone here. It's also like the people who came before and the people who's coming after. So it's, you know, it would make sense. You try and link it in this space and time and the different spaces and times.
That's where I think the Kota figure is relevant, because the Kota was a function of between worlds. So that's where it's relevant. Not so much because it looks like a quota, but because it has this function. And I think that's where, if you're interested in this, maybe even unconsciously.
Yeah, possible. I mean, he was raised Christian, but like, it's not sure like to what degree that means. But then also, you know, like understanding, you can't be a humanist without trying to engage with other religions, even if you identify strongly with your religion. You see, I would agree with that. So then why not? Like, just, yeah. Mm. So, because the reliquary thing isn't necessarily a Christian thing, but still is. And then, yeah.
But I think the you know, the point you're making about the in-betweenness, I mean, it's, you know, it's perhaps why he's presenting it to us in this sort of fragmented image. You know, I think there's a lot to be said about it that has yet to be explored.
But one thing just about the figure. So what I found about his work is, for the period from 19, say, late 50s to 19, I mean, true to the rest of his life, but really from late 50s to 1985 mostly, he made work that is similar to this reproduction you see here, which is, it's a reproduction, so it's hard to see, but there is a figure which is not perfectly obvious, and as Nomusa says, you kind of have to look for it, and then it's there, and it sort of shimmers in and out of vision, right? Like it's like it's a person. Oh, no, it's not a person. You know, like that kind of like dissolves in and out of it. But then from 1985 onwards, he changed, and he stopped making figurative. He made a different style, not obviously figurative whatsoever. So that it's just interesting to see that maybe the message of being human, you don't have to carry the human in it, either as a real human or like as a quota, like a reliquary for a human. Mm-hmm. And that part, I think, is kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. I don't know that. Am I making sense? Yeah?
There's a quota up there. He has one.
Yes, actually, that was the other source. Yes. I did forget. So I did say the quota, primitive Negro sculptures. I've got like teachers here. I'm gonna get like a point. Teachers. Primitive Negro Sculptures, the book, British Museum, where he stopped off on his way to Paris, the Musée de l'Homme, which is now the Musée Guy Branly now, and then also through his wife, a famous Danish collector of African objects, called Kirsmeyer. And there's a picture, kind of like a book. I can't walk over. Oh. Okay, never mind. Anyway, somewhere over there. Okay, so that's, I invite everyone to look at it afterwards and identify the quota and the thing and the book. And so that would have been another place he would have encountered it. Yeah. But actually, I just feel like he was such a sponge and that he just absorbed so many. He was so interested in so many things. There's a couple of things I'm going to draw you to. So there's the exhibition, if you like, is sort of spread into two bits. This is sort of like an interpretive room, if you like, of which there are little books. And there's one book where I've got permission to make a copy of a letter he wrote to who would be his wife's. So during the war, because he was in Paris during the war, right? So he was interned for 4 years in a prisoner of war camp. Not because he was black, but because he was British. And he wrote a letter to his wife, would be his wife, and where I guess the prisoners all entertained each other by giving lectures to each other. And he wrote to her and said, I gave a lecture about sculpture and covered Egypt, Greek, Indonesian, obviously the Renaissance, obviously the Greek. But then I couldn't go very deeply because there wasn't a lot of time. And this was like written in 1942 or 43 or something like that. And he had just arrived in Paris in 1938. So that sponge of like, you know, just wanting to be interested in all these different things and then wanting to share it, like that was already there.
Mm. Yeah. But young Parisians in those days were buying African sculptures just to decorate their houses because it was in fashion. Mm-hmm. Like this Afrophilia, you know, was kind of on the rise then when he arrived. So people would have had African sculptures in their lounges and, you know, things that they'd collected. But the other thing I wanted to say about that Kota Relinquary figure, and I'm not sure about this, I stand to be corrected, but I think it would have also appeared on the posters for the first festival for Negro arts in Senegal, when Senghor had just put into place as a cultural policy Negritude. Mm. And I think he would have used it as well as a sort of symbol of Negritude. Mm. And then the other thing I wanted to say, sorry, back of my mind, and two very different things that aren't logically connected. But just as you mentioned his later style, I think also quite interesting that he begins to develop this style that looks like a language. Mm. So it's as if he's writing onto canvas. And again, we're doing the work of trying to find this because they look like little letters, but we can't quite, you know, say that this is something legible, right? So it becomes, you get thrown into the space of illegibility as well. And I think that sense of being in between worlds is an illegible space. A space that is not legible.
Yeah, I agree.
Like, if I could say this in Zulu, would make that.
I woo.
Mazel tov.
So, this, like, just moving away from Mankoba for a minute. Just one thing that I think is really interesting. What art does is, for me anyway, is it creates a space to think. And you understand something, but it hasn't been named yet. That to me is the most interesting art, where there's something and it's tickling my head and is making me think, but I can't name it, I can't express it. And it's through the thinking that eventually I will name it or I will be able to say it in words. And that to me is the most interesting art. And that's what's kind of, you know, kept me really interested in Mankoba. Like, what is this? What is it trying to do? Why does it look that way? Anyway, that's the thing for me. That probably was like a critique about our time. So I'm just going to say one more thing and then I'll let Nomusa wrap up. It was about words. So Ernest was an amazing visual artist, but he also just wrote beautifully. And all the people I've spoken to who are still alive and speak about him will say he just spoke in paragraphs and essays. And I'm really fortunate to have had a reproduction of a letter. So in 1962, a very famous and amazing Danish art person, Troels Andersen, commissioned Ernest to write an essay on African art. And Ernest wrote that, I think, in one go, based on the ink blots and the scratching out, and that's probably his son's exercise book. And then he, Ernest, and Troels Andersen translated to Danish, and it was subsequently published in Danish, but it's never been published in English. And I've been lucky enough to borrow it so that I can show it. And I would just really highly recommend that you read it because it is very moving. And what I just said about visual art giving me something to think, but without naming, I would say that this piece of essay did something for me the same, and it's in words. So. It's like, I just find that interesting. How could you, like, in words, create something in visual art in my head and then something in visual art that creates words in my head, you know? So that's where I'm going to end. I'm just going to ask Nomusa to please finish off for
yes,
us.
Yes, I guess as a parting shot, it's just to thank you all for being here and also to ask you to join us tomorrow, join the conference tomorrow, because I won't be there, and I apologize for that.
Because she's so busy. She's flying out to Chicago with another right conference. After.
but we're looking forward to all the conversations that will happen, and we hope that they won't just end there, and that they will generate some interesting writing as well about my mother's work. Thank you.
So the exhibition, thank you to Josh, who did this in like 2 days. I don't know how you did it. Well, we were able to borrow some works, and it's on the third floor. So please make your way up on the third floor to see real works, not just the reproductions. And then, of course, food will be served by the amazing Robert Mulders of 6th Spin Street. So I hope you can stay for that, too. But thank you very much.
Thank you.